June 9th, 1983, we're interviewing in his office, and this is Laura Smale.
Where'd you get all this?
There is people.
It's a collection of various people's comments.
Oh, I see.
You see, it's so that naturally someone disagreed with it.
Yeah.
And this is this. But this is an alphabetized index. It's by, you know, it goes right on through from A to Z. The numbers refer to interviews. Each interview has a number.
Okay.
So what I'll ask you, that's sometime when you're retiring, why we can do something more thorough. But today I'll ask you about Steenbach, about the other people in biochemistry who came here. Mm-hmm. What you know about the Enzyme Institute, the molecular biology. That's okay. You've been interviewed by other people, but you haven't said why you chose the UW or how you had to come here.
Well, I chose UW from recommendations from the faculty at the University of Colorado, where I did my undergraduate work. They recommended the Department of Biochemistry at Madison as being the very best in the country, so that was the reason for choosing Wisconsin.
You weren't recruited from him through the friend. I think he just was recruited from around UW.
No, I was not recruited.
Yeah.
I sent an application in for graduate school to the Department of Biochemistry because of its reputation.
Yeah. And how did you happen to work with Steenbach?
Well, at that time, the way graduate students were taken into the department was that each individual professor would offer assistantships to students, and they would go over the applications, and Steenbach offered me an assistantship, and I accepted.
Mm-hmm. Did you know any of the other people here?
I'd read about Elvium, Hart, Snell, McCollum,
mm-hmm.
Who was no longer here, of course, but I read many of the discoveries made here, which also intensified my interest to come to Wisconsin.
Well, you presumably didn't know about Steenbach's reputation. He seems to have been given some of his graduate students a hard time.
Well, the only thing I knew about Steenbach was his fame as a research investigator and his fame for the vitamin D irradiation patents.
Mm-hmm.
That is all I knew about him before I came here.
So you were pleased then?
I was pleased to receive his offer, yes.
Well, would you try to describe what people have talked about him in terms of his teaching, of his research, of how he handled his lab? Could you know better than anybody else.
I never heard him teach because by the time I came, which was in 1951, Professor Steenbach was not involved in formal coursework teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So the teaching I was exposed to was what he provided his graduate students in his own research laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Steenbach is probably one of the very best people for training graduate students.
If you don't mind holding this, the air conditioning is so loud.
Yeah, I believe he was an outstanding person for training graduate students. Now, the style in which he ran his laboratory is different from how I run my own laboratory. He was very Germanic in the way the laboratory was run. You were expected to be in the laboratory from 8 to 5 and 8 to 12 on Saturday, and except for when you were in classes or when you had a legitimate reason for being away. He did not permit radios or whistling or things of that sort in the laboratory. His idea was that this interfered with the work of others. And other well, in my laboratory, I pay no attention to things like that. I don't know who's right in that score. I mean, radios do sometimes disturb people who don't want to listen to radios. But his style was very, very Germanic, very rigid, and somewhat severe.
Mm-hmm. The idea was that most of the labs were run something like this back in the 30s, but had it changed by the time you came?
Well, Professor Alvium ran his laboratory in a very similar way, except he wasn't around very much. Mm-hmm. For example, Professor Alvium would appear in the animal room Saturday and Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock, and he'd expect his students to be there tending the animals. Mm-hmm. It was a style at that time. Now, Steinbach was here most of the time at a time when it was changing. For example, Esmond Snell, Henry Lardy, Bob Burris ran their laboratories in the style that you'll find now throughout the department. There isn't anyone who runs a laboratory like Steinbach or Alvium ran their laboratories. So in fact, some of it was a changing times. And he didn't change very, very easily with the times. And so his laboratory did have a reputation of being a very severe place to be in. And we would be subject to jokes by other students, you know, well, did you get let out of the laboratory today? Or did you have to sign out to go to the bathroom? Or things of that sort. And at time, especially initially, it was difficult to adapt to that. But I think the other compensatory features that I got to know in Professor Steinbach more than compensated for that, the way he ran his laboratory.
Were you proud of working for him?
Oh,
a sense of that?
Oh, I was.
Take the joke if they wanted to, but.
Yeah, I think I was proud of working. I mean, here is a man who contributed so much and did such superb research in his prime. Certainly by the time I came, he was in his 60s, late 60s. He'd had very ill health for 20 years. And perhaps he wasn't doing the most modern of research. And so there was that point to it. But nevertheless, his ideas on how to set up experiments, how to interpret results, how to write. He was superb at writing. And he taught me how to write. I didn't learn how to write before I began writing things for Steinbach. So, it was a mixed thing. But, I mean, this university should look back at what this man has done for this place, for this department, for this entire university, regardless of the little things that they might pick up on in his personality.
Some of the things that have been said about him were that he wasn't getting as good graduate students. Obviously, you're an exception, but later on, that he tried or he controlled what they were to do more than some other people.
I think that's a bunch of baloney. Okay, I mean, the people that say this are the people that weren't in his laboratory. Okay, and I'd say that other people more rigidly controlled what the students did than Steinbach. I had a relatively free rein within a fairly large project area. As long as I went in to him with a good idea, and I had a good idea of how I was going to go about doing it, I was never blocked by him. So I think that's just not true. And I think a lot of this is founded in jealousy because Steinbach was a tremendous investigator. When you look at some of the early work and some of the deductions he made, there's no one that can criticize his capabilities in this area. I mean, he was a brilliant investigator. And so people who say that he didn't, know how to, you know, conduct research, I think they're incorrect. Those are people who weren't in his laboratory. We didn't work on the most modern methods because Steinbach had a 20-year lapse when he was out with ill health. And most of us have trouble staying pace when we're in the laboratory all the time. So it doesn't surprise me that he didn't have all the modern techniques available to him.
But he apparently did have equipment in the 1940s. He was getting in some of the new equipment, the spectral...
He was the first person to have radioisotopes to be used in this department. He had Geiger counters. He was a very forward-looking person.
Did he have it before Bob Burris?
Yes, he did. Oh, yes, he did. Steinbach's lab was probably the very first to have isotopes being used. Now, the question of whether he didn't attract very good graduate students, that's an interesting point, because the way the selections were done in the old days was that the junior staff committee or whatever it was under Professor Phillips would go through the applications initially and fish out some of the ones that they thought would be exceptional, and those would get filtered off. And then Steinbach would then be able to look at the next bunch of applications. Well, so maybe in a sense he didn't get a look at the very best students. So, and I'm one of those not very good students. So I guess it's a matter of how you measure students. No, I think that he was one of the most misunderstood people in this department. I got to know E.B. Hart, and I got to know Dr. Alvium, Frank Strong, Snell. They're all wonderful people. I mean, they all were just great people to know. But Steinbach, who kept himself isolated, had more incorrect things said about him than any of the others by a long way.
Well, apparently he really didn't relate, but he wasn't very friendly to, certainly to other graduate students that weren't his own. And that would have created some...
Well, I can tell you my experience that I saw when I was a student. Certainly he looked after his students first, and I do the very same thing, and Bob Burris does the very same thing. Now, he was a person who believed in rules, and if we broke rules for no good reason, he would be very quick to come and criticize and lecture us and verbally abuse the person who is smoking when it's sign says clearly no smoking. He would do this to other people's graduate students as well as his own. If he found them doing something that they shouldn't be doing, he was not reluctant to tell them so. And so I think in that sense, he certainly mistreated other people's graduate students. But it wasn't directed at them because they weren't his graduate students. He just didn't like to see rules broken. For a while, he shared this laboratory back here with Professor Snell's students. And of course, that's a difficult situation. This is his laboratory. He built this wing with his own money. Okay? He, in short, Snell's people were a guest of his. Well, one of these people, who's a very famous biochemist now, literally destroyed a lab bench by just sloppiness. And he came under abuse from Steinbach. I mean, how would you feel? You built something yourself, and this guy abuses it and thinks he has it coming because his professor hasn't told him how all of this stuff came about. So I think you got to understand, you know, this person. He was a very generous man. He had a very great sense of humor if you got to know him, if you let yourself get to know him. And you could understand his rigidity and get past that. I don't know of a person who is less selfish than Steinbach in all the time I've been here. And that's saying a lot, because you go talk to a person like Bob Burris, who's about as unselfish as you can find, or Henry Lardy. Two of the most unselfish people you can find on the campus today. And I say Steenbach was even more unselfish because he gave so much. You know, he expected to be thanked for it and acknowledged. And that was perhaps one of his failings, because no one likes to continue to thank someone for something that's given. And he sort of expected to be appreciated that way. And I think he felt very disenchanted because of that. But consider what he did. He could have kept that entire fortune to himself. And we hear all kinds of things about Steenbach and about how he was forced to give up this money. That's just absolutely false.
I have never heard anything like that.
You know, he never took a cent from those patents. He put it into an account.
Yes, I understand.
And he stood that.
They didn't take the 15%.
Yeah, but he never took anything initially.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know that. I think that's
well known. Yeah, well, it's just, you check around. Yeah, there are a lot of people who have misconceptions about that. So, and then after he got a certain amount of money from his 15%, the rest was left at Wharf and this building and the 56 building were built with those monies. The professorships were created from these monies. Just a lot of things that he gave the university were created, came from his own personal money. You could look at other people who benefited through the Wharf system. Carl Paul Link, for example. Do you see anything on this campus that came from Carl Paul Link? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you go and look around, because he was one of the prime critics of Steenbach.
Yes.
And how selfish Steenbach was. But I don't see anything from Carl Paul Link. I don't see that one fellowship, that he created one fellowship in his own name or something. He never gave a cent to the Department of Biochemistry.
Mm.
He never gave a cent to the university. So McIlvaine in chemistry, who benefited from Wharf money, I don't see that he even put his patents into Wharf. He kept them himself. And so you can go right down the road and it's very hard to find someone more generous than Steenbach. And also, I think his foresight, I mean, it was just a tremendous amount of imagination at the time that Wharf was created, for him to conceive of this instrument. Because, you know, at that time, he was considered an odd professor that would even play with this dirty stuff called money. And to even conceive of profiteering from investigation was just unheard of. But his vision was, okay, let's let research pay for itself. And you know, it's I feel pretty badly about Steenbach, because I think he was misunderstood, and a lot of people, because of the kind of personality he had, don't give him credit for what he deserves to be given credit for.
It's good you have a chance. Did he praise you? Or you said he criticized. Did he also praise you as students?
Oh yes, when you did a good job, you knew you did a good job. When you did a bad job, you also knew you did a bad job. No, he certainly did. He did to me. Now,
yeah.
Maybe other people will say, no, he never did.
Well, the only other student I've talked to of his is
Carl Baumann.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He was from an earlier era.
Yeah.
And he would have been probably during some of Steenbach's prime, when he was a really prime investigator.
I didn't ask him much about him, because he was the first person I did in this series, so mm-hmm. I didn't ask him much about his teaching. But
I hear that Steenbach was not a good lecturer.
No, they all agreed. Apparently, well, with one exception, most people think Link was.
Oh, Link was a superb lecturer. Oh, yeah, I think he was. I think he was a showman. Mm-hmm. And he wasted lots of time being a showman, but when he got down to lecturing, he's essentially unbeatable. He was just superb.
I'd like to ask you about Johnson. I was very pleased to see that you're starting a Marvin Johnson mm-hmm. professorship, because he's somebody that's emerged, for me anyway. Everybody has talked about how he was relatively unknown.
Yes. Marv Johnson is not someone who reaches for the limelight. He's a brilliant man, very nervous type. There was an era of professors in this department, which was this, I'd call it the second generation professors, which included Johnson, Strong, Burris, Lardy, Bauman. Let's see, who else? But these were some of the most easygoing, tremendous people to work with I have ever seen. And Johnson was one of these. Brilliant person, brilliant lecturer. He made physical chemistry and kinetics seem so simple. Mm-hmm. And all my previous professors labored over it and could never get there. So he was a superb teacher. He was a gadgeteer. He had more inventions that, if he had patented them, would have probably overshadowed everything that everybody else had done. Mm-hmm. He invented the continuous fermenter, which is in common use in industry mm-hmm. everywhere. He invented the first count rate meter, which if he had sold it to the radiochemical companies at that time would have made a fortune, and so forth. There are millions of things that he just came up with. Brilliant person. To say he was a great trainer of graduate students, I guess that's debatable, because his style was very hard on some students because he was nervous and jumpy. He would just attack, and everyone was just frightened to death of him. Because, he was brilliant, and his mind was very agile. And it made students fear him.
Did you know him?
Oh, I knew. I knew John.
Did you fear him?
No, not after I got to know him. At first I did, because his reputation was, was just mind-boggling. He was so brilliant, and he asks these penetrating questions, and if you get him on an exam, he's going to destroy you, and all that sort of thing. Well, I took his enzymes course, and he wasn't any of these things at all. He was just a brilliant lecturer, and his exams weren't that bad. And so when I got to know him, and I went down and got advice from him on bacteria, and I got what is called a preliminary examination from him. But after that, and after, if you stood up to Johnson and fought back, he respected that. And after I did that, we became very great friends, and I'm a great admirer of Johnson. I think he's one of the major unsung professors in this department.
It seems evident.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
I don't know whether you want to comment on Link and the whole business about dicumarol and...
Oh, sure. Sure, I'd be glad to tell you what this all happened before I got here, and so what I know is hearsay. And I have been privileged to some documents that maybe other people haven't been, because I'm chairman of this department. Link ran a very excellent organic chemistry laboratory, the only one here. And I think he himself was a brilliant chemist. There's no question about it. He also had some brilliant people working with him. Campbell, Stahmann, I can't remember. Well, I've heard he was. I didn't know him. Yeah, I don't know how brilliant he was, but his work was certainly very strong. Stahmann is not a brilliant person, but he was an extremely hard worker. And Stahmann has to be credited with warfarin, nobody else.
There's a whole series of documents.
You've seen those, so I don't have to comment on those. There's no question that warfarin really, really was majorly Stahmann's, and in fact...
what I understood was that he got the patent on dicumarol, and that the warfarin was later.
No, it's just the opposite. see, Link, and I don't know if Campbell was on that patent or not, but...
No, he wasn't.
It was Link...
Miyoshi.
Miyoshi on Dicumarol?
Ikawa. We're on the Dicumarol.
Yeah.
I don't know about...
Yeah, now the warfarin was done, was synthesized when Link was in the sanatorium. Okay, and because this laboratory was under Stahmann's direction at that time. That's what I understand. Now, I wasn't here, and you could easily check this out documented and get it documented. Then what happened was that Stahmann went away. I think it was to Rockefeller when Link came back. And Stahmann kept pursuing patenting warfarin. It wasn't called warfarin at that time, the chemical name. And it is my understanding that Carl Paul Link didn't think it was of any great significance. But Stahmann, in his persistence, kept at it. And I think he went down to Indiana.
Yes.
And then at Indiana...
They wrote back and forth.
Yeah. And I saw Link's letter to Stahmann that says, I don't think this is of any consequence. If you want to patent it, go ahead. And so Stahmann did. But his patent attorney said... to make it a stronger patent, you should include everybody that's on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, that was probably Stahmann's fatal mistake from his own point of view, because later he was not given credit for this. In fact, my understanding was that there was an attempt to exclude him from the royalties from this thing. So,
what Bob Burr says was that they suggested putting 20 people on as profiting.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the ins and outs. That's all inside Worf, and so it's all hearsay. But certainly, if it hadn't been for Stahmann, warfarin would not have been a money earner for this university. Yeah, there's a lot of bitterness in those early days. Some brilliant investigations, and yet some just enormous animosities. No, I think it's a different group of people. I don't think we can call it management. They're different personalities. Yeah, my personality is different from Elvium and Hart's. There's no doubt about that. But I think also you have people like Burris and Lardy that set the picture in this department. And believe me, that is extremely important, because as I grew up as a graduate student among these professors, I was shocked when I hit the real world outside this department at how other professors were like, because they weren't like...
What do you mean?
Well, you know, underhanded and steal data and stuff like that. I mean, these people would never dream of that and would never tolerate it. I mean, and so you have to consider that these were the members that formed the background of this department when I became chairman. They made it easy for me.
The second generation, but also the first or the second generation?
Well, they're the second generation. I mean, I consider Steenbach, Elvium, Hart as the first generation, and this group as the second generation.
Okay.
Now, these people, I think, made it very easy for me because they set the stage. And if someone went off, and we have had a couple of circumstances where a professor gets a little screwy, the rest of the staff rallies right behind you, you know, and we put them in their place. And I got a lot of help, you know. We don't have that in this department now. The last person that showed any of that was Orm Johnson. He's at MIT now. So,
what do you know about did you have anything to do with the Enzyme Institute?
Not any more than, it was established before I came here. When I came as a graduate student, the Enzyme Institute was fully operational with two units, Lardy and Green.
Yes.
And I understand that, I guess I'd better not. I think that Burris would probably be more in a position to comment on the origin of the Institute, and Henry Lardy also.
Well, I've interviewed Henry Lardy and Van Potter together talked about it.
Okay.
I was just curious as to your impressions of Green, because he seems to...
Okay, I can give you that. When I first came here, this department was actually on a plateau, and the Enzyme Institute was the place where the really exciting biochemistry was being done. Mm-hmm. Henry Lardy's lab, superb. Green had an army of people over there, and Green was kind of unapproachable, and you know, the big professor in enzymology, but Lardy was not that way. I mean, he just spent hours with anybody that went over there to get help, and I was one of those. And I'd say Green's lab did some very excellent biochemistry. He had some very brilliant postdocs over there. I'd say he's not among the most brilliant scientists that have been over there. I mean, there's no doubt about Corona. We don't even have to talk about him. Mm-hmm. But Lardy is an outstanding person, and you never know it when you talk to him because he's so down to earth. Yeah, but I mean, he's not filled with himself.
No.
You know he's brilliant when you talk to him. But he's...
That's what direct man.
Oh, yeah. He's made a number of outstanding contributions. Yeah, starting with when he was a graduate student. He's just a brilliant person. Superb for students. Superb for a university. And he contributed a major amount to making that institute what it was in the 50s and 60s. Green was very big in the 50s and diminished to very low scientific stature in the 60s.
I really got the impression that from points of view like Potter's and Lardy's, he was never very, and they were both very disappointed in his work.
Well, they had more direct contact with him. No one can deny that the discovery of coenzyme Q, which was done by their group over there, was an important discovery. And some of the cytochrome work that was done during the late 50s was very good enzymology. Now, how much was Green and how much were these postdocs who are now, like Henry Mahler at Indiana? I mean, there are a number of brilliant people that went through there. Frank Hennekens, who's down at Scripps Clinic, Oceanography. These people, you know, made some great contributions. So Green created the atmosphere. How brilliant Green himself was is debatable, because he came out with some things which were later very drastically disproved.
Oh,
cyclophorase.
Yes.
That was complete garbage, and he tried to sell it.
Yeah.
And I think that is probably what Van Potter
was
referring to, and Henry Lardy. But even more important than that, Henry Lardy's group made some very important breakthroughs in fatty acid oxidation, mm-hmm. and Green's group literally lifted it from that lab.
Yes, they talked about that.
Yeah.
I didn't get it that clearly.
I'll give it to you clearly, because Lardy wouldn't say it, but I will, because I know that's what happened. Because Drysdale in Lardy's laboratory, Drysdale was a fairly warped person, but brilliant, made a very important breakthrough. I remember as a graduate student, I remember hearing about it. And then Gibson, and I've forgotten who the other person was in Green's lab, all of a sudden they're coming up a year or two later with the same stuff as if it's theirs. And I think it was too bad that Lardy was put over there, frankly, because he would have been much better if Lardy had been given adequate space and facility in this department.
He was put over there to counteract Green.
That's correct.
So.
But he also got an ulcer from it.
I know.
He also suffered from it.
Yeah,
and I think it's most unfortunate that.
Yeah.
And I think our students lost a lot by not having Henry Lardy here. Because this was the place where graduate students were, and I wish we had had him here. I'm selfish. I wish I had been able to rub daily shoulders with Henry Lardy. because he certainly is an outstanding teacher and research person and an example of what a scientist ought to be. So, then they brought in Gobind Khurana, and I really don't know who spotted Gobind Khurana first.
Well, they talked about that. Yeah. I think Lardy did first, and watched him from the time he was in Cambridge, and then Van Potter was the one who proposed to be brought here.
Yeah, well, that certainly was a brilliant addition. Whoever was responsible, he certainly put Wisconsin in the forefront in this area, and I'm sorry we lost him. We had him back giving Steinbach lectures,
yes.
And he did a beautiful, beautiful job. Completely new stuff. Totally new from what he got his Nobel Prize for. But it's the same quality work. And Nomura is excellent over there now, But the Enzyme Institute, center of biochemistry shifted back now to this department.
I thought you were going to say molecular biology.
To this department. Molecular biology never really has gotten off the ground, in my view.
Right?
Not that laboratory molecular biology, no.
How come?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not the one to ask, I guess, because I was here when the laboratory was first conceived.
Yeah.
As with the Enzyme Institute, what happens in a department of this sort is that there is resistance to moving into new areas.
Yeah.
Okay. And there was resistance to moving into enzymology in the old days. I don't know who was responsible for that resistance in this department, but you probably have somebody who could tell you.
No, that I haven't heard. I mean, I know that Elding and then somebody else were giving a seminar in enzymology in the 30s and 40s. Them.
Well, maybe you should ask, I don't know who you could ask, but one thing is certain, enzymology could not have developed in this department at that time, and that is why ultimately the Enzyme Institute was created. The same is true with molecular biology. This department should have had the addition of molecular biology right to it, because it's a specialized biochemistry. But I was an assistant professor sitting in on the faculty meetings then, and you could see that there was no way you're going to add two or three or four molecular biologists to the staff. There was going to be resistance. Well, then came the development to keep Harlan Halverson and Ernst
Fries,
from leaving. And so I remember the vote came to the staff whether we would agree or approve the erection of a laboratory for molecular biology that would hold joint professors between departments and that are doing work in laboratory molecular biology. Well, this department, especially with the second generation people, are really a very magnanimous bunch, and they thought it was a good way to go. And Caseberg, sitting in at that time, said, well, we in biophysics have been thinking about the same thing. And so at the same staff meeting, approval from this department was given for inclusion of the laboratory of biophysics. And so there was sort of like a walk-on.
When you say they wouldn't have taken four people in, was it because of money, or they didn't want... Would it be like history not wanting to take the third world history people in?
That's very possible. There's that, and there's maybe not the greatest respect for molecular biology in its infancy, and we don't want four people like that on our staff.
So it was really a recognition that, or a feeling that it wasn't quite what biochemistry.
Yeah, and we want to add more people like ourselves. That's always a tendency in a department. And it takes real foresight, I think, to look around and say, look, this is where science is going next. This is where we want to add. And I don't think that the whole faculty was ready to do that at the time.
You said the faculty was on a plateau around the early 50s. Well,
I'd say during the late 50s and early 60s, when enzymology was the major development in biological science. Not much of it was being done here in this building. A little bit by Elvium, they hired J.N. Williams, who was more of a nutritionist than an enzymologist. And so that development never took place in this department, and it should have.
Was that because of the chairman? Or?
I don't know. I don't know what the reason is.
Well, when did it start taking off? Did it take off?
It took place in the Enzyme Institute. They had.
But then you say it came back here, that the strength.
Well, now we added a whole bunch of new faculty members, in Julian Davies, who's now left, but Hatch Eccles, a number of younger people had been added, who then began to do exciting work, and the students became more interested, and we began to add more people in areas that were developing, and I think that the exciting work then shifted over here.
Was this something that you worked hard at?
I think I certainly worked hard in the whole department. I think we got a cohesiveness in this department that just seemed to gel at that time. And
before it hadn't, because you felt that really what was happening somewhere else.
Well, there was one problem. You're asking opinions, and these are only opinions.
Yeah.
Professor Elvium was chairman of this department. He was also dean of the graduate school. Mm-hmm. He also had huge laboratories of people, and I don't think he had time to consider the future of this department. Mm-hmm. And I think the leadership was not present during the late 50s when this should have taken place, when the faculty members should have been added, where if I had been chairman, no way would they take Henry Lardy away from me.
Yeah.
You know? No, I mean, I would certainly put up a fight for that, because I could see the impact of this man on the rest of the department. And I'd want to look for someone else, like maybe I wouldn't have let Van Potter escape us either, because he is a brilliant man and an inspirational character. Or if you, not him, at least there are many other people around the country that you've been able to pluck two or three of them here and really turn things on. So, and I think Elvium wasn't focusing on that at the time. He just wasn't. He was at the end of his scientific career. He had his eyes on something bigger. For whatever reason, I think he was interested in the graduate school. I think he was interested in the ultimate presidency. And so this department was sort of an orphan. Bob Burris took it over, and Bob Burris, I think, began the building process. And it just, you know, there's always a lag time. And furthermore, Bob Burris is not aggressive. I mean, he's a nice person. I'm aggressive. I mean, I'll go after what I think the department needs, and I think that's the one element that I perhaps added, is a really aggressive determination for this department.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went after and got some of the things that I thought we ought to have, and so I think now, you know, we have a lot of really brilliant young people in this place.
Yeah, you just lost four of them.
That's political too. You know, yeah. Julian, of those four, Julian Davies was the one real loss.
Mm-hmm.
The others.
Oh, I see. That was just.
Yeah. Don't say anything else.
All right.
But, you know, also the chancellor and whatnot. I mean, Irv and I are good friends, and he knows that I'm pulling for this department, and so. I think Julian Davies, of the four that left, that was a loss. The others are ultimately replaceable.
Were they all students here?
No.
So they weren't?
No, Julian Davies did do his undergraduate, I think it was undergraduate work in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, he, that's right, he got his PhD in organic chemistry from Van Tamelen when he was here.
Mm-hmm.
But then he went into biology at Harvard, and I think he did an extended postdoctoral stint.
Okay, I can find out.
Yeah.
I was just, somebody said that now all of your faculty are people who were here, who read here.
No. No, we, as a matter of fact, John Suddy was the last person we hired from our own department. Everybody since then, except very recently, we hired Paul Ludden, who was one of Burris's students. But all the others, the molecular biologists upstairs, they're all from elsewhere. Bruce Selman, a plant biochemist from somewhere else. Ellen Addy, almost Chris Rates, Dave Nelson. They're not from this department.
When you went off to Cambridge, did you know that you were coming back here?
Yeah, I had been hired. See, Dr. Alvium offered me a faculty position before I went to Cambridge.
And you accepted it without question, did you?
Yeah, I wanted to stay.
Going anywhere else?
I thought of going somewhere else, but I mean, there was no place like Wisconsin. You know, if you go to any department, it's just not, with all of the problems, this department still ranked in my mind as the number one place to do academic research. And so when Alvium offered me an instructorship in 1958, I think, he did it right out here in his very terse way. I accepted. Well, then I went away, but then I think very shortly after I came on the faculty as an instructor, Dr. Alvium became president.
Yeah.
Burris was elected chairman. And there was a mix-up, and so I remained as instructor for 2 years, which made Steenbach really angry because it was an omission on Burris's part. He just taking over the job. This is one of the things that he missed. So then I went for, I think it was like 8 months to Cambridge, and then came back.
No. It says 55 to 57 on
here. No, 55 to 57, I ran Steenbach's lab for him. I was a postdoc. 58, I became an instructor and was an instructor for 1 year. And then I went to Cambridge.
To the
Strangeways Laboratory to do tissue culture work. And about 8 months later, I came back. And by that time, I was made assistant professor. And then I came back here. And by that time, Steenbach had retired. I think 1957 he retired. And so I inherited his lab. He still maintained his office, and he'd come in on occasion and interact with the students. He never interfered with my running the laboratory or directing the students. And I took over some of his former students too and finished up their project.
Does he will it to you? Or
well, see, when you become emeritus, you cannot be in charge of students anymore.
Can he decide who's going to take it over?
Well, what happens is the department, the faculty voted on having me join the staff, the faculty. And that was under Alvium, and that it was their intention to program me into the taking over the vitamin D.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, both Hart and Alvium. Hart, before he died, was very supportive. I think I got to know him very well, mostly talking to him in the hallway. Professor Phillips, who was head of the staffing committee, was very strongly in favor of this. And I don't remember what the vote was for the faculty, but they voted to give me an appointment. So I was on the staff, and Steenbach then volunteered to pay my salary as long as I ran this laboratory. So.
Oh, and that's how the funny thing that Burris talked about came up, where Steenbach said, "Why did you find some money to pay for a while, and then what he did, why Steenbach said, "You're stealing my
Oh, I never heard that.
Really?
Well, yeah, there was more to it than that, because Steenbach was really angry because Burris missed that promotion, you know, that 1 year. I was supposed to be an instructor for 1 year. Burris missed it, and Steenbach was down on Burris for that for a while. Now, I don't know about this
thing. Well, it sounded like it's just one of these sort of nice absent-minded sort of things. I mean, you can see why he might say, aren't you ever going to find money to pay my Tech and DeLuca? And then when Burris did...
Then you want to take him away.
He's stealing my grant.
Steenbach could do something like that.
Yeah.
He might do something like that.
Yeah.
I don't doubt, you know, what Burris says is, I'm sure, absolutely true. I don't think Burris has lied in his life. there was that aspect of Steenbach. Once in a while, it's, you know, when he got onto something, you were damned if you did and damned if you didn't. You know, he would do that. And then he'd get himself out of it after a while, you know. When I wrote my first report for him, he didn't like it. And he at first told me, just go out and put your data on a table. So I did. I quickly put it on a table and brought it back into him. And he said, do you call this a report? I said, I thought you wanted the data, not a report. He said, I want a report. Now you go out there and write a report. I wrote the report, and I'd come in, and he'd say, what'd you take all this time for to write this report? And so I don't know why he did that, but he did that. And the real turning point, and this was in the first semester I was here, I finally turned in this report to him, and so then he read it, and he just came out, had me come into his office. They sat right over there. And
this
is his office, his desk. It was against this wall. It wasn't that desk. That was in his office downstairs. And he would, he just went through and said, where did you learn your English? And, you know, this is terrible. And so he just was just insulting me, you know. Yeah. Finally, I had enough. I got up and I said, Professor Steenbach, I will take constructive criticism. I've got a lot to learn. But I am not going to stand here and be insulted. And I said, I'm going to leave. So I walked out the door, and he came out and got me and said, where are you going? And I said, well, if I am that bad, you can't want to waste your time training me, so I'm going to leave and go find another lab. And he says, well, you come back in here. And so he showed me a couple of things. He said, now go out and try again. So I went out, and I took... I mean, I know I had a lot to learn about writing, so I did my very best, and I brought it in, and he just praised it. And he said, okay, this is a brilliant way to write a report. It's very nice. I haven't seen a better first report from anybody. Okay. My troubles with him were over after that time. But he went through one of these things where you couldn't do anything right, no matter what you did. And I'm sure that Burris, being a new chairman, could not do anything right either, and so Steenbach probably got him into one of these boxes where he's trying to steal my person. Well,
yeah.
Why don't you pay him?
Yeah.
Now there was that aspect of his personality. With Steenbach, you got to go back underneath these multitude of defenses that he had from being hurt, because he had a very retiring personality.
Yes.
I think he was easily hurt.
I've interviewed Evelyn Steenbach, and mm-hmm. talked about his, you know, his life and his parents and all that.
Yeah, I think he was very easily hurt. Mm-hmm. He had very thin skin, and he developed all these really mean defenses.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever got beyond them, there was a really wealth of a man. I mean, I used to spend hours talking with him.
Mm-hmm.
We just had such a good time discussing things, you know, and. Science or almost anything, nature, politics, religion, whatever. I spent hours sitting here talking with him. He'd come in at 8 o'clock at night, and I'd see him, and we would start talking out there. And he said, "Well, why do you want to stand out there? Come out into the office," and we'd just sit and talk. Sometimes it'd be 10:30, and he'd look at his watch and say, I didn't do anything tonight. I was going to do this manuscript. And then we would have spent that time talking either science or something interesting. Very interesting man. He thought about a lot of things. I didn't always agree with his point of view. And I could tell him that I didn't agree with it, and I'd tell him my reasons, and he'd respect that. Whereas I had the impression from the outside that he was so rigid that if you didn't agree with him all the way down the line, he just wouldn't have anything to do with you. That's not true once you got to know him. But his defense is, you know, to go out and attack. Well, I heard him attack Professor Anderson in the hall because he's leaning against a wall, no smoking sign, okay? And he has a pipe. This billows of smoke. And Steenbach said, well, when I heard this, the whole conversation went up to Anderson and said, you're leaning against a no smoking sign, and there are some people who don't want to breathe in the smoke. And I don't, you know, I insist that you not smoke. And he's an assistant professor. And Anderson responded, well, I consider it my inherent right to smoke. You know, very arrogant treatment. Well, then that elicited a real tirade from Steenbach. The reason is that he believes that rules should be followed. He thought this professor was not following rules. What an example you are to a student. And he was off. And so now you'll hear that he, you know, ridiculed a professor, you know. He's poorly understood man. Very difficult to know, get to know. I agree with that. You'd have to work at knowing him.
Were there how many others did of his students?
I'd say a few. Probably Jack Kramer, who was in the lab at the same time, and David Herding, got to know him pretty well. Before my time, Howie Schneider, got to know him very well. Carl Krieger, Jimmy Lowe, Templin. There were some others that really suffered from him. For example, there was